Off the ball.
Rugby.
And there was no doubt there was a lot of disappointment in the Galway air that they didn't have this win, because they're sick of losing interpros and they're sick of losing to Leinster. That's 13 defeats in a row to Leinster, and it's 10 interpro defeats out of 10 in the last two seasons.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Hey folks, it's Cameron here. So the 2026 Winter Olympics in Milano Cortina is fast approaching. The opening ceremonies on the evening of Friday, February 6th, so just over a week to go. And this will be Ireland's ninth appearance at a Winter Games, with our debut coming in Albertville, France in 1992, in, of all things, the bobsleigh. And the story of how Ireland made its first appearance is fascinating. It could have happened 4 years earlier, in fact. And one of those bobsleighing debutantes, Terry McHugh, himself a six-time Olympian, throwing javelin at four games between 1998 and 2000, was kind enough to speak to me ahead of the games, so we thought it would be a good idea to share that full conversation with you here in advance of the games getting up and running very, very soon. If you want to keep up with all things Winter Olympics over the next month, the best way is to head over to Off the Ball's Road to LA feed, where you'll get access to the finest interviews with Team Ireland's Olympic stars, medalists and medal hopefuls. Before that, enjoy my chat with Terry McHugh, Winter Olympian for Ireland in 1992 and 1998.
Where in the world are you?
I'm speaking to you from Switzerland, in a village called Adligensville, just outside of Lucerne town, about 6 kilometres outside of Lucerne. I live in Switzerland, have been here now for the last 20 years or so.
Right, cool. What kind of work are you doing over there?
As an ex-sports person, it can be difficult to define your work, but I'm national coach for discus and javelin, and that's a part of my full role, but it's probably about 30-40% job. And then there's also a big athletics meeting we do in Lucerne every year, and I'm responsible for the athletes and logistics around that. And I also do a bit of coaching in a sports school and a club, so still involved in sport.
Yeah, and summer sports, which is a really interesting strand to your story of getting to Albertville and starting up the sort of the drive of Irish Winter Olympians. So your athletics background would be primarily discus and javelin and the throwing field events?
Primarily javelin, just javelin. I threw javelin, I threw shot, I threw discus, but in terms of world level, I mean, javelin is the only one that would have been, you know, on a higher level. The other two were just throws. But I mean, when you can throw one thing and you understand the concepts of it, you can coach the others quite easily.
Yeah, because I've spoken to people like Marita Walton-Lanigan before and others, and it's amazing to me, given the sort of history of Irish athletics, that for almost a century and a half, like, the throwing sports were ours. You think it's sort of the Irish Wales in the US in the early editions of the Olympics. Well, what kind of happened, I guess?
With regard to throws, I'm glad to hear you mention Marita. I haven't heard her name in a long time. She's actually still the Irish record holder for the shot put. She did that back in the 70s, I think. We've had a massive history of throws. At the turn of the century, previous century, as you said, we had the Irish Wales. So a lot of Irish people who left the country and subsequently just big farming people got somehow associated with the throws and had a lot of Olympic success for America. So there was kind of a connection made. They call them the Irish Wales, these people who won medals for America, mostly. Then we had Pat O'Callaghan, 1928 and 32, our first double gold medalist at the Olympics. And yeah, it's just, throws are something we've always been quite good at. And I wouldn't say we're kind of the poor relation in terms of track and field, but there's a lot of development these days. If you looked at the distances O'Callaghan has thrown to win the Olympics, I mean, they were literally what you would consider to be good club-level throws now. And there's a lot of investment of time to develop a technical athlete. Nicola Tuttle, you mentioned. Nicola, for me, is one of the best turning talents in the world. That girl is absolutely phenomenal. So we have the basics there, but then you have to find the event and you have to have the right coaching structure to help you develop it to full potential.
Part of it as well, the sort of, as the end of the 20th century came, rugby turned professional, and you look at some of the famous throwers from generations before that, like Gary Halpin is one that comes up straight away. Did that kind of fill the need that sort of athletes of Gary Halpin and others' build, that they might have gone to the sort of throwing events, given that that would have been the one they excelled in, and now there's a professional outlet where maybe they can turn their attention. Did that kind of hurt it maybe as well?
I'm sure it definitely still hurts it. I'd be absolutely convinced it hurts it. Victor Koskalo was another. He made the shot put Olympics in 1992 and he played rugby for Ireland. Gary Halpin threw at Worlds. But I mean, if you're coming through the system now and you've got a crossroads where you can actually throw or you can play rugby at the level that rugby's played, if you can make an Irish squad, you're literally in the top tier of the world in a sport and you get paid a salary for doing it. I would say it's certainly an easier decision to make. I'm not saying it's an easier route, but it'd be an easier decision and there'd be a lot more fame and recognition and financial reward attached to it. So it's another route for people to pursue in sport. I'm not saying it's better or it's worse. I'm not a particularly good spectator of sport, but the one thing I do like to follow is Irish rugby because it's phenomenal. It's absolutely phenomenal. When there's a game on, you know, I like to watch that. So the people who can play that, I always say there's a huge crossover. There's a talent pool. As national coach here, I'm always arguing a little with the federation, but there's a pool of talent. And the people who fall into that pool, who can do what, who have the requirements for the sports that we're wanting them for, they have options. And I mean, I'm not picking on myself, but I use myself as an example. Like, I've bobsledded for Ireland. I've thrown javelin at the Olympics. I played National League basketball. And I actually played handball for Ireland once upon a time, more universities handball thing. But the point is, if you can do something at a high level, most probably there are other things that you can do. I have a young athlete. She'll be starting in the Olympics in Cortina in a couple of weeks. She'll be in the back of, hopefully in the back of Swiss sled number one. And she was a javelin thrower with me for about 6 years. One of the best, one of the most talented female athletes I've ever met. And she left javelin throwing. She made it to Swiss record holder briefly, but she left javelin throwing to pursue bobsledding. And just a week and a half ago, she was in the back of the bob winning the European Championships for Switzerland. So if you can do one sport, most probably you have the ability to do another. So if you were stuck with the choice of throwing or playing rugby, I could absolutely understand people making that choice.
It's funny you mentioned that because you're the real case in point here with someone who's able to transfer or transition from javelin over to a sport maybe other people would have thought is poles apart. It's a good jumping off point on how Ireland actually gets to the Winter Olympics, because it really, the story kind of starts in the 80s, really.
For bobsledding and Winter Olympics.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a very good documentary made by a filmmaker called Jason Brannigan called Breaking Ice. And after a chance interview on Irish radio about just a little over 4 years ago, I think, he heard it. And he had no idea how Ireland got involved in winter sports and came after us to actually find out and made this little documentary. The film itself shows the path that... shall I go into the detail or just give you a quick overview?
No, go into the detail. Spare nothing.
It was Irish... I suppose he's Irish... Irish-parented businessman living in England called Larry Tracy. And Larry was on a holiday with his wife in St. Moritz. He was a successful businessman, and his wife, for a birthday gift, organized for him to go in the back of a sled for a tourist run in a bobsled. And he found it absolutely exhilarating. And at the end then, he said, that was amazing, but I'd really like to sit in the front and actually drive a sled. And they said, sorry, it's not possible. First of all, you need to have a driving license. You can only get a driving license if you're a certified driver. You can only become a certified driver by being nominated by your federation. And he thought this was ridiculous. So he checked. There was no Irish Bobsled Association. So he formed the Irish Bobsled Association. Then he wanted to go to a driving school. I think it was in St. Moritz. And he sellotaped a note on an Irish rowing boat at the Henley Regatta, I think it was, basically saying, recruiting for the Irish Bobsled Association, anybody interested, please call this number. Because he had a background of rowing himself. He was a personal friend and I think even a sponsor at one point to Steve Redgrave's 5-time Olympic gold medalist in England. Larry's a fantastic character, a very given person. So My subsequent driver, Pat McDonough, was the one who found this note, and himself and a couple of the guys, Jerry Mackin, I think, they made contact with his number thinking, this is bizarre, but it sounds like a bit of fun. And Larry said it was quite serious, and he organized and funded for the guys to go to a bob school in St. Moritz. And at the end of the bob school, there's a competition, and they actually did well at the bob competition. And then they got their licenses, and they headed off and started to compete. And I don't know what the year of that was. It's very clear in the documentary. But by 1988, they had actually a lot of driving behind them. And I think they qualified two bobs to the 1988 Olympics. Legitimately qualified two bobs to the 1988 Olympics. But it was an absolute shock to the then Olympic Association of Ireland. And
right,
they refused to send them. The World Bobsled Association, Federation International Bobsled and Toboggan, wrote to the Irish Olympic Association saying these guys are legitimately qualified. From our point of view, they're eligible to compete at the Olympics. And Olympic Association just refused to send them. They thought it would just be a disgrace to the nation. They knew nothing about it themselves, and they refused. So I think Larry then took a high court action to actually injunction or whatever to try to make it happen, but time ran out and they weren't sent. So at the end of 88, having qualified but not been sent to 1988 Olympics, Larry, Cormac Smith, Jerry Mackin, Sean Tunney, and a group anyway, they had to make a decision, carry on or stop, but they decided to carry on. Pat McDonough then in 88 was at the Seoul Olympics as a rower, and I was at the Seoul Olympics as a javelin thrower, and they had started to try to recruit athletes into the sleds. And he mentioned to me, and I knew from two friends of mine who had gone and done a little bit, that it was quite a bit of fun, quite dangerous, quite exhilarating. And there was a trials after the 88 Summer Games in Seoul in Belfield. So I went to the trials, won the trials, and a couple of weeks later, I'm sitting in a bobsled in Winterberg in Germany at a European Championships.
Gosh, what's that like, first time?
It's very bizarre because in our sport of track and field, you know, to make a European Championships could take you all of your career. But if you actually think about the bobsled as kind of two parts, the front part is the driver who has to have the skill to navigate it down the track right side up and as quickly as possible. But the requirements to be a brakeman are literally stupid enough to get in and do it. Very strong, very fast, very powerful. You literally are the engine to get the thing moving. And after you get the thing moving, you've got to get yourself in and not disturb the run. You've got to know the track, but basically that's it. So the power requirements for the back of the sled are almost identical to that of a power athlete, you know, sprinter, thrower, good jump, strong jumper, that sort of thing. So suddenly I'm at a European Championships and I learned the sport, literally. It was very exciting.
Because it's as you say, it's strength and it's also timing and technique. Like, there's so many components. And also when you get to foreman, there's a lot of different components. So that it must be interesting from a javelin perspective to go into what's essentially a team sport almost straight away. Is that a different dynamic?
Of course it is, yeah. I mean, I had played team sports, you know, I played the basketball, that sort of thing. But like you talk about the foreman, the first time we ever embarked on a foreman campaign was for the 1998 Olympic Games in Nagano. And I remember we were in Innsbruck, Austria, and we rented a foreman sled. And I think we had a journalist with us at the time, maybe Cliona Foley, if I recall correctly. And Cliona was actually sitting watching us on our first attempt to get into a four-man sled. And I'm talking about in the shed. Because you have four sitting places and you just say, okay, stopwatch, go. So the driver gets in and then the three guys have to get in behind him. And it was absolute comedy. It must have taken us about 5 minutes to actually find where you put your feet, where you put your hands. And we knew what we were doing. But the thing about it is that there's a sequence. So driver in, second person in, third person in, fourth person in. But second and third have to stay up. Mm. And number four has to drop in, get down. Number three has to sit and secure his position. And number two then has to sit and secure number three. So that you're all literally in unison and holding each other into the sled and locking yourselves as a one-piece unit in behind. And when you go into a sled for the first time and you're trying to find where your feet go and where your hands have to go and where you're comfortable to hold and where your shoulders aren't hitting and the side of the cowling and your head's that, it's absolute comedy. So we had to get something down from 5 minutes to literally 3 seconds eventually, you know. So that was, first of all, very amusing, but quite challenging, challenging.
I mean, I might get on to Kleene and see what that was like from outside.
I'm pretty sure it was Kleene. I think it was Kleene.
She paint a good mental image of what that was like to witness. What was Albertville like? I know it's it's the Christy Yamaguchi Olympics, basically.
Yeah, Albertville for us was actually very bizarre because we were doing World Cups, we were doing European Cups, and that's just basically, you know, you're on the circuit doing bobsled, you're with bobsledders. So suddenly we were going to this massive event with all the other winter sports. But sadly, because the requirement for the bobsled is a track, the track has to be where the track is. It can't be moved. So we were actually terribly far away from all the other events. So we always described Albertville as a World Cup with good food and a crowd. So the only time we actually saw the Olympics was when we came for the opening ceremony.
Yeah.
And we marched in the open ceremony, and then we were like away about an hour and a half, 2 hours away back in our mountain doing our thing. But the difference was you had a crowd and you had TV cameras and you had interest, and it was the Olympics. But it was really the Olympics with better food, and it was a World Cup with better food and a crowd. But, you know, the Olympics is exactly the same as the World Cup, is exactly the same as the European Cup, is exactly the same as the European Championships, except it's the pinnacle of the sport, and the people you're with are the absolute best. It's not number 20 to number 60. It's number 1 to number 30. You know, so that's the real difference.
Yeah, because like that's such an interesting point that doing the kind of reading up that it took place because it's Albertville, and I know Milan Cortina will be the same, where that's the official host city. But I think Albertville took up place between the different events over an area of like 600 square miles. Like calling it an Albertville Olympics is a bit of a misnomer. Is that typical that you're just kind of spread all the way out and this is kind of just the focal point, but really I think only a third of the events happened in Albertville in 92?
Well, I haven't kind of traced the path of the Olympics. So from our experience, you know, I competed in 92 and 98, so Albertville and Nagano. We actually would have qualified for 94, but the new Olympic Association refused to send us. So the thing repeated itself. Long story, different story. But in 98, in Nagano, we actually lived in the village. So we actually lived in the village, so we mixed with all the other sports, and that really gave you the proper sense of Olympics. I mean, I used to struggle to describe it. You know, it was just this buffet of 24-hour food and all the rest of it. But in holiday terms, it's the full, what do you call it? When you have the full package, you've got free food, free drink, all-inclusive.
Yeah, all-inclusive.
I didn't understand all-inclusive, but the Olympics is literally, you know, an all-inclusive sports event. And so we lived in the village. We shared space with, you know, speed skaters, skiers, snowboarders. And then we traveled maybe 45 minutes to an hour in our vehicles to get to our venue. So it was a much more of an Olympic experience in Nagano.
What's the, when you're there, it must be novel for all the sort of Nordic countries and Switzerland and the US to have an Irish team there. But 4 years after, or 4 years before Albertville, you have Jamaican bobsled team, you've Eddie the Eagle, Edwards. There's a sense that there's a danger there that, sure, it's the Winter Olympics, it's only a bit of crack. Like, it's just these mad fellas going off and doing, like, the Jamaican bobsled team. How can you take the Olympics seriously? Is that something that you experience when you go over? That it's, and now the Irish have a team, right? Okay.
I mean, I live in Switzerland now. Hmm. So if I talk about Irish bobsledding, you're talking to people who are in a nation that wins medals.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have been considered an also-ran, but definitely not a joke.
Okay.
I mean, it's actually quite amusing. First of all, that's probably what stopped the then Olympic Association sending the first bob team. because it could have been seen as a joke. And that what you referred there to Eddie the Eagle and the Jamaicans, and they both appeared at the 88 games where the Irish would have competed. But the Irish at the time would have been a novelty because we didn't, you know, we didn't have a track. Jamaicans were a bigger novelty. But Ireland were beating Jamaica. So we were serious, but we would not have been contenders for medals. So I don't know. It'd be a bit like me saying as a javelin thrower, you know, when I go to an international thing, that there's somebody else in the field who's kind of always there. And I don't consider them a joke, but I don't see them as a threat. Mm. It'd be more like that. And I mean, if we were to be viewed as a joke, my good friend Gary Power, who was also in the bobsled with me, Gary recalls the story that we went to a World Cup in Calgary, Canada, and it was, you have equipment controls. So underneath the sled, you've got these runners, about a meter long, metal blades almost, that you bolt on the sled, and that's the contact with the ice. So in terms of cars, it's your tires. So the Swiss and the Austrians turned up for runner control. You have to declare them, you have to show them, they have to check the measurements to make sure they meet the specifications. And we turned up with our box of runners, one box, four runners for one sled. So whether it snowed, whether it rained, or whether the sun shone, that's what was going on the bottom of our sled. The Austrians, I think it was, turned up with 24 sets of runners.
Right.
24 sets of runners. So they had all of these pieces of equipment that they use these ones maybe if it's minus 20. They use these ones if it's minus 15, if it's minus 10, if there's rain, if there's snow, if the sun shines. So they had options on material and equipment, and we didn't have that. So from that point of view, you were never going to be as competitive. First of all, you're possibly renting a sled because it was too expensive to bring the sled that you might have had to the other side of the world for one event. So first of all, you're rented equipment. And secondly, your runners, which are the most important part. Your selection is just selection of one. So from that point of view, you were not seen as a threat. You know, because the probability of actually beating them with that equipment. And I saw it firsthand when I came to Switzerland. I had a young shot putter I was helping in my club. He wasn't a phenomenal athlete, a good athlete. But he was, I'd say, far below any of the Irish people who were involved in bobsledding. And he went briefly to bobsled and competed at the Europa Cup. Now, we competed at Europa Cup and we come in like in the 20s. And he went first time competing in Europa Cup, and he wasn't half the engine we were for pushing the sled. And he was in third place in his first event out. So he was just the engine for a good piece of equipment with a qualified, experienced driver, but with the proper runners. So the difference is that, you know?
And that it's a great point, because I, from what I've gathered in my sort of limited knowledge of the whole thing, it is the equipment that is the difference between nations, and it's more closed source. So the German team have a sleigh and the equipment around it that's designed purely for the use of the German team. There's no sharing of that information. It's all a kind of arms race. That must make it very, very difficult for an Irish team to compete, because I think, is it in 98, you borrow a sleigh from the Prince of Monaco?
Yeah, both of those stories are correct. First of all, the arms race, I mean, obviously, everything has a price. And when we went to Canada, for example, the sled builder in the Canadian shed was a former Swiss sled builder that they had brought in to try to keep up with the Swiss. And he had an apprentice. I think it was his apprentice name was Hugli, and the Swiss guy was Hildebrand. So the sled coming out was a Hildebrand sled. And then the later sleds coming out of the shed was a Hildebrand Hubli sled. And then later on, it was a Hubli sled. And he was well regarded because he'd, you know, been an apprentice to a very good builder. So they would try to keep that to themselves as much as possible and give themselves a competitive edge. And for the 1998 Olympic Games, our whole bobsled campaign was actually run on rented equipment for four-man. We had no two-man sleds. Too expensive. And even if you bought them, then too expensive to bring from track to track. So we had to be very strategic. We picked tracks like Calgary, Canada, Innsbruck, Austria. Just pick those two. So you've got a European track and you've got a North American track, where we specialized in those tracks. So every event that was on those, we tried to get our drivers there so they got experience on those tracks. So when there was a World Cup event or a European Cup event, we gave ourselves the best chance to be familiar with the track, you know, because we couldn't afford to be on the circuit all the time following the thing around. So when we decided to do the four-man campaign and try to qualify a four-man sled, it's quite funny, actually. The first sled we rented in Canada, believe it or not, was the sled used in the film Cool Runnings.
That's a terrible twist of irony.
No, but it was absolutely awful. Like, we had this black sled with Jamaica still on it, and we're like, that looks familiar. And then we were chatting around, so what's the story? And somebody said, oh yeah, that's the sled that they used for making the film. It's still knocking around the shed here. We'll rent you that. And our driver at the time, Pete Donahue, was delighted, but we were not happy. The actual one of the biggest problems was that the sled itself was extremely heavy. It was a proper sled. It was a proper sled, but it wasn't the top end racing sled. And there's a weight limit, and we were all quite big people. So when we were all in this sled, I think we were something like 25 kilos over the permitted weight as a team. So we wouldn't have been allowed to compete in it. So that was our rented sled. So we had to take weight out and eventually found another sled, thanks be to God. And we carried on with our campaign and we qualified. Now, when we qualified for Nagano, we didn't have a four-man sled and we didn't have contacts in Nagano to rent a four-man sled. So Prince Albert of Monaco, being the half Irishman that he is, knew of our plight, and we talked to him and basically said, would you have a sled we could rent? So he was traveling to Nagano with two four-man sleds. And the deal was, we could use his second four-man sled, but if he ran into equipment problems, we would have no sled to compete at the Olympics. We'd then have to go locally and try to source a four-man sled. That just sounds ridiculous when I say it. But that's the agreement that we had in place. And the sled we used at the 1998 Olympics was actually Sled 2 from the Monegasque bobsled team owned by Prince Albert. Thank you, Albert.
Wow, that is phenomenal.
Yeah,
I think for everyone's sake, for the pride of the nation, using the Cool Running sled in 1998 would have been just a bit too on the nose and a bit tough to get over.
Introducing a new Off the Ball football podcast original. Richie McCormick's Sliding Doors. These are the stories of those big money deals that just didn't quite happen.
Figo. Ronaldo. Made space for himself. Ronaldo's shot. Oh. Pick that out. What a hat trick.
Episode 1 of this podcast series focuses on Ronaldo and a move to Glasgow Rangers. Subscribe now in your OTB football podcast feed to not miss an episode of this 6-part series coming to you live each and every Monday.
You've mentioned just what you're doing now and the work that you're doing with athletes and guiding them towards, if track and field isn't their thing, like Bob said, might be their thing. It could be the way forward. And it feels like, you know, we've seen it in Ireland, given the kind of range of sports and options available to people, that there's probably loads of people just falling through the cracks from an Irish perspective that could be great, that maybe just don't have the physical wherewithal or just the shape to make it in track and field, but could be incredible bobsleighers or winter Olympians. Is it just a case of access that we haven't had more? Is it the equipment? Like, what is really standing in the way? Because you mentioned the women's bobsleigh team. Our first and last team was in 2010. We haven't had anyone at the Olympics since. So what's the big barrier, I guess?
I think to run a bobsled campaign from Ireland, you're at a massive disadvantage. You really are. You would be doing it in a similar way to how we were doing it, unless you have massive funding. I think the future of Irish bobsledding success And it's not intended. It's no slight on anybody's physical abilities, but we had a skier in 1992 called Pauli Schwarzegger-Joyce. And Pauli at the last Winter Olympics, I think, was chef de mission for the Austrian team, if I'm not mistaken. Pauli was Pauli Schwarzegger-Joyce. So the Joyce was there. So one of his parents was Irish. So Pauli was born in Austria, literally at a ski place. And from the age of two, he was probably on skis. So he is Irish. He could have an Irish passport. He's got the infrastructure on his doorstep, and he's born with the event. So if we had a similar situation with an Irish expat, I think you call them, in Canada, in Switzerland, who actually, you know, is born near the facility, who gets the experience, let's say, to drive a sled, that's the best chance you have. And then Irish athletes could be recruited to push behind them. But it would still be a disadvantage because my son, for example, he's been on skis since the age of four. He's a very, very good skier. But I think if you were to try to set an Irish Bob Association at a Swiss track, you would always have the pushback from the local federation who owned the track. You'd never really have ownership of the thing. So you'd still need a big sponsor to actually buy the track time and all the rest of it. And I'm sure that the Irish winter sports team at this stage is made up of such people around the world. I followed it a little bit there, and it's been phenomenal to watch and great to see so many. I met them at the Olympic ball last November, I think it was, of 2024, I think. I was at the Winter Olympic table. Super talented people, but some of them, you know, Irish parents living in other places. Sadly, with the sort of sport that is, so equipment dependent, so track dependent, to really have a chance to compete, you'd have to be that close to it or massively funded.
Because when you talk to some of these athletes, Elsa Desmond's story is fascinating in that she set up, quite like Larry Tracy back in the day, she had to set up the Irish Luge Federation to be able to qualify for 2022. And I believe she's going to be in Milano Cortina at this stage. But when you talk about Irish Olympians, generally, it's a real, like, you're self-made, you're a sole trader, you kind of have to do it all on your own. And when it comes to Winter Olympians, particularly from Ireland, it's that tenfold. Like, you really, really have to roll your sleeves up. And as you've kind of alluded to, have an incredible amount of luck. So is there a point, I think Jerry Macken says that having a competitive bobsleigh team from Ireland would be like asking Swiss lads to take on Kilkenny and beat them in hurling. Like, it's that unlikely. Can you ever foresee us being?
You've just mentioned something there. You said luge. We could, and you probably know this, we had a fourth place at the Olympics in skeleton.
Yes.
With Lord Clifton Rothersley III.
Yeah.
Okay. So luge and skeleton are different. The equipment is literally 25 or 30 kilos. It's compact and it's transportable. That is something we could actually do well at. And Clifton showed it at the time. And this lady you just mentioned there, she can be competitive. If she decides that she wants to dedicate herself and she's got a good enough sponsor to put her at the side of a track, to get the coaching, the equipment's not too far away. You know, a bobsled is a different thing. I mean, it's, 170 kilos or something close. Anyway, somewhere between 170 and 200 kilos at this stage. I don't know what the new measurements are on it. But I mean, it's a massive piece of equipment. It's logistically a nightmare to bring it around the place. Luge and skis, those sort of things. It is possible for Ireland to have success. But access to the facility and coaching is the bigger part of it there. Bobsledding, it will always be a little bit obscure. It'll be always a little bit difficult unless you had the set of circumstances, like I say, in Calgary, Canada, where two Irish guys of Irish ancestry were living there, had access to the best equipment and access to the track and a sponsor. Yeah, they could be competitive. They could be competitive. But it's got to be somebody who's up the front driving the thing all the time.
Last one, I suppose, just to finish. Milano Cortina, just around the corner. Is there a sense, because, you know, for lots of reasons, it doesn't quite capture the imagination until it's on in it from an Irish perspective. But I imagine in Switzerland and around that area of continental Europe, is the hype kind of building every 4 years when this kind of comes around? Yeah, it's really taken off, is it?
Yeah, it's massive. I mean, we have, you know, you have hurling every week at home, or you have rugby every week at home. But I was in Tenerife there just 2 weeks ago for a training camp with some of my elite javelin squad. And one of my girls during training kept sneaking down to look into her bag. And I said, "What's up? What are you at?" And she said, "Oh, I'm just keeping track of the skiing. Like, there's a Swiss skier from the inner Swiss area, Odermatt, and he's won, I think, 5 World Cups in a row. He's young, he's good looking, he's talented, you know, and literally the eyes of the country are on this guy, and the expectations of the country are for him to bring home all the medals."
Right.
So people, it's a bit like the Roger Federer thing over here, you know, when he was, people were watching tennis. So skiing is already popular, but they have a superstar at the moment. So there's a huge awareness of it. My own son actually will be going to the Winter Olympics, told me the other day. A friend of his won some raffle on the on a QR code on a beer bottle.
So okay.
He's going to watch the speed skating at some stage up in Cortina. I thought it was a scam, but it turns out it's real.
Yeah,
so, you know, there is that presence. It's here. People are involved in it.
That's such an interesting part that the skier now and the Federer comparison. Like, from your time in Switzerland, just to finish, is that a big thing? Because I know when we're here, there must be similarities between Ireland and Switzerland, that when you have someone on a global stage, whether it's in sport or like you look at, say, Jesse Buckley at the moment in the Olympic, that it's a great sort of showcase for a place that's maybe a little bit off Broadway in terms of like international recognition. And Switzerland feels like it's quite in that place too. Like, Federer is the first person that comes to mind when you think of Switzerland, and there's not a whole pile of other people. So when someone like that comes along and they have that international prestige and recognition, that must be a big deal for the Swiss.
Yeah. I mean, it's a population of about 8 point something million. So it's bigger than Ireland, but not dissimilar to Ireland. We've had the Federer over here. Before Federer in tennis, you had Hingis in tennis. And in Ireland at the moment, because obviously I do follow what happens, I mean, track and field in Ireland with Rashida and people like this is just on the up. And you can see what it does to a small country when you have somebody who can compete on the world stage. And Switzerland are having exactly the same thing. We have the Kambunji sisters. One has just won a world outdoor 100-meter hurdles. One was second place in the 200 meters. We have Simone Hammer in the long jump and multi-events like Kate O'Connor. And it absolutely creates a consciousness and awareness through a small country when you have somebody who can stand like that in the world stage. And it's really good for the sport, really good for the country. And they're very patriotic people. Very patriotic people. When the Swiss flag is flying, obviously, everybody's in. Same as Ireland with the rugby or athletics or soccer.
There you go. That was my full chat with Terry McHugh, 2-time Winter Olympian in 92 and 98. And once again, if you want to keep up with all things Winter Olympics over the next month or so, the best way is to head over to Off the Ball's Road to LA feed, where you'll get access to the finest interviews with Team Ireland's Olympic stars, medalists and medal hopefuls. As we document the journey to the Los Angeles Games in 2028, you'll be able to find exclusive content with the athletes, plus conversations with legendary voices of the past too. So subscribe to that feed and you'll be kept abreast of everything and all things Olympics over the next while. But thanks for listening today, and we'll talk to you later.